Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
We have got a lot to talk about. At the threshold of the weekend, here we are. Votes will happen Saturday, we're told. And the reason why we can tell you that now is because an important vote just occurred. The magic number, 316 to 94. They got the rule passed. And around here, that's news lately. Ask Speaker Mike Johnson, who has seen seven rules fail on the floor. What happened last night in the Rules Committee? This is procedural. I get it. We're wonking out. This is the kind of stuff. This is how the sausage is made. And you may not want to look because it's not pretty. But last night in the Rules Committee, it took Democrats to pass the framework for the bills to be voted upon. The Rules Committee, known affectionately as the Speaker's Committee, this is supposed to be a rubber stamp for the Speaker, and three Republicans said hell no. So it took Democrats to come in here and get this done. And once again today, look at the number, 316-94, Democrats. This might not play well for Mike Johnson when it comes to this whole motion to vacate matter. But let's get to the Hill right now. Billy House has been watching all this unfold before his eyes, remembering that the Supplemental Emergency Funding Bill passed the Senate back in February. Ukraine has been waiting for that long. And so has Israel, for that matter. Billy House with us right now. Billy, we're looking at a working weekend. And I guess the glide path is set here. Are these all going to pass based on the numbers we saw today?
Well, it looks that way. This test vote today was very strong, but you're correct. Actually, more Democrats, 165, voted in favor of Johnson's package, foreign aid package, than his own Republicans. Only 151 of them did so. That'll probably follow suit tomorrow late afternoon in the final vote in the House.
Remarkable comments from members on both sides with regard to Speaker Mike Johnson and what he has just accomplished or not, depending on who you ask. Tom Massie, who signed on to this Republican from Kentucky, the motion to vacate with Marjorie Taylor Greene, he writes, the U.S. House is now officially in an alternate universe where the Speaker shares procedural power with Democrats. Is he wrong about that, Billy?
He's not wrong about that, but what he's not really saying is that the narrow majority the Republicans have demand that no matter who's Speaker. They've already run through one, Kevin McCarthy, and now the same things or requirements or challenges are being hit by hit on Johnson, Mike Johnson, his successor. So, yeah, it's a new universe, but it's not a universe either the Speakers really have control over. They just happen to preside over it.
Mm-hmm. We heard from Speaker Mike Johnson a little bit earlier today. Listen to the language that he used in trying to frame the differences between this legislation and that which passed the Senate. The House could have taken that up, brought it to the floor. We were told that it would pass, but he chose not to because of opposition from conservative Republicans, namely members of the Freedom Caucus, who aren't probably going to vote for this thing anyway. Here's Speaker Mike Johnson from earlier today.
It's not the legislation that we would write if Republicans were in charge of both the House, the Senate, and the White House. This is the best possible product that we can get under these circumstances to take care of these really important obligations.
He's making the case here. If you couldn't understand what he was saying, I know it's noisy and he's surrounded by marble. Not the legislation that we would have written if Republicans were in charge of both the House, the Senate, the White House. Billy, he's right about that. Mike Johnson seems to be the one person who knows he cannot pass this with his own conference.
Well, that's correct. But what he's saying there is that they were able to put in such things as a loan concept in the funding for Ukraine or sanctions on Russia and Iran in this process he's put together. That some different things than what would have been in the Senate bill. Still, Ukraine has waited and waited and there's been a lot. The world has waited for the U.S. to either act or not act on this as the House has kind of rolled around trying to figure out what it was going to do.
What should we know about the motion to vacate then, Billy? I'm sure that's the talk on the Hill. If these all pass tomorrow, they get stitched together, it goes to the Senate. What does Marjorie Taylor Greene do? She said, you vote on Ukraine, you bring it to the floor, and you're fired. But we haven't seen that happen yet.
Right. And we were all eyes were on her this afternoon. I mean, this morning when this vote was taking place. But she left the House floor in kind of a huff, saying she wasn't going to talk to anybody. Now, she could trigger that motion and force a vote on the House floor on Mike Johnson's future. But he could also first call for a vote to table it. And so what we saw today with the Democratic help on this package of bills, some people are saying, and some Democrats are saying, they're going to help rescue Mike Johnson on that. That'll help him, obviously, but in the long run, what's a speaker or a Republican speaker's future if he has to rely on Democrats to keep him speaker?
A working weekend, Billy. I wish you luck. We're going to be watching for your reporting, of course, on the terminal and online. Billy House, Congress reporter here at Bloomberg. He is part of the woodwork up there, and he knows what he's talking about. We'll stick with Billy and the rest of our congressional team as we advance to these votes tomorrow. The Senate would then, of course, take that House bill. The president's already said he'll sign it if he gets it. We could be in a different world come Monday. And after what happened last night, you do have this urgency. A lot of people pointed to the attack from Iran against Israel for relighting the fires on Capitol Hill to get this thing moving a lot more quickly. And Israel has now responded. You probably got the alerts from Bloomberg last night against Iran following the drone and missile attack last weekend. State TV in Iran says military and nuclear facilities safe. They're showing pictures of the city, people are driving through intersections like it's any old day. But that might have been the point here. There was a lot of worry, of course, about Israel overreaching. And we had a lot of questions as we asked General McKenzie here yesterday about what would be a proportionate response. That's where Mick Mulroy comes in. He's co-founder of the Lobo Institute, former U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for the Middle East, with us now live on Bloomberg. Mick, it's great to have you. Thank you. Israel had a couple of different audiences with this response. What did it accomplish last night?
So, Joe, I think they wanted to accomplish a couple different things. So the first was they couldn't let this unprecedented attack on them by Iran just go unanswered, or they would have set a different paradigm in the Middle East and one that they didn't find acceptable. The second, I think they really wanted to show that if they wanted to, they could strike deep into the heart of Iran in the location where they both have an air base and one part of their nuclear facilities complexes, if you will, that they use to develop the uranium necessary to eventually make a bomb, if that was where they're going, and that's where many people think they are. So, but they did so in such a limited manner that it was more symbolic, but important symbol rather than really made to cause destruction, it appears.
Interesting. Ian Bremmer tweeted earlier that this was, in fact, a de-escalatory move. And I wonder if you agree with that, having been so precise and so careful not to overreach. Did Israel just end this for now?
Yes, I agree with that. I think this was certainly intended to be a de-escalatory move where, again, it was limited, largely symbolic, but it did show essentially that Iran couldn't even stop this. I mean, they're probably special type of munitions that are very difficult to detect, but obviously weren't detected until they were well into Iran and struck near the target. We haven't seen a battle damage assessment, but essentially I do think it was very minimal damage. And I do think the intent, along with not talking about it, except for one notable exception, the Israeli cabinet has said nothing about it. So they don't want to poke anybody in the eye with the idea that this could contain this confrontation and essentially start moving it in the other direction, which is de-escalatory and likely back into the shadows of where this war has been fought for the last several decades.
Fascinating. Well, it sounds to me like you think they struck the right balance here if de-escalating was in fact the goal. Reports, Mick, say that the U.S. did get a heads up here on this move, but did not green light it. It's an important distinction. What do you make of that?
So, Gerald, that's just something that the U.S. was concerned about because of the strike in Damascus. They didn't believe they got a heads up, which is unusual, I have to say, having been in roles and been involved in notifications when it comes to this. Usually, Israel does give us a heads up. This time, they obviously did, too, probably because they had issues because they did not in the strike in Damascus. It killed those senior IRGC Quds Force generals. But this time they did. I don't think they were asking for permission, but I do think there was an ongoing discussion with Israel starting higher up the escalation ladder, if you will, when it came to their original mm-hmm. course of action, and then progressively going down in the last week and to the point where they got to this. The United States isn't going to greenlight it, but I do think they felt that this was something that the United States would accept more, and more importantly, would accept it because it looks like de-escalate the situation where Iran doesn't look like they're going to retaliate.
We're spending time with Mick Mulroy of the Lobo Institute. The area that was targeted here, Mick, Isfahan, was significant. And what you said is important here. While we may not be talking about massive destruction, they wanted to prove that they could reach deep into Iran without being intercepted, certainly not the way Iran's attack was. But this is home to Iran's nuclear program. What kind of a wake-up call is that for Tehran?
So, Joe, that is the wake-up call. So Isfahan is the third largest city in Iran. It's deep in the middle of it. It has two facilities, one in Isfahan, and then another in Natanz, which is only, I think, 70 kilometers from there. That's a very difficult target. But it does show that they could get these munitions into this location without being intercepted, either in the air near it or actually striking the ground. And we don't know, and might not find out. But it does certainly show that Israel has the capacity to strike in Iran when it needs to, even when it's expected. Because this has been built up and people expected, and I'm sure that the Iranian air and missile defense were on high alert, right? So even when it's telegraphed, they still were able to do it, but they did it in a way that we think didn't cause much damage. And so I think they did strike the right balance here. And I think the U.S., if they would comment, would agree that this is about the best scenario to de-escalate the situation. Mm.
Mick, what did you make of the attack by Iran a week ago? A lot of people said this thing was made to be intercepted, that they telegraphed for a week they were coming. They gave Israel hours notice. And of course, we know that 99% of the drones and missiles were, in fact, knocked down. Was that the aim by Iran? Are both of these countries tiptoeing around each other?
I think you could make that argument, yes, because of the delay. And the delay actually allowed the U.S. military to move assets in the region to intercept the missiles. I mean, if you really wanted to cause a lot of destruction, you would have likely gone immediately. That said, it was so many. So, you know, ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, and drones, 320 total, that were sequenced, in my opinion, to basically end up in Israel at the same time. So yes, they launched the slow-moving mm-hmm. Shahids first, but then they started getting caught up with by the ballistic cruise missiles and the ballistic missiles, right? So yes, they have really had to rely on the capability of Israel to intercept that many, along with the United States and UK and our Arab partners. That was a big risk. I mean, there could have been things that gone wrong and it could have caused catastrophic damage. But I do think it's fair to say that Iran wanted time for this to happen. But they did send a pretty big risk, or put out a pretty big risk, that all these would be intercepted. But it's also important to know they launched a lot and they were not successful.
Yes.
So I know they tried to couch it as some kind of victory. But from the military perspective, it looks like even with all their capabilities they launched, they had zero effect on target, essentially. Zero
effect. Gosh, that's for sure.
I think that's also important.
I just wonder. It's super important, Mick. I just wonder how much we learned about our own capability. Even if Iran slowed this down so we could knock some of these down, surely they didn't bet we could get 99% of them. And while we've had a lot of war games to show our abilities to actually do this in the field, in the wild, and pull it off in reality is a different matter. Mick Mulroy, great to see you. Thank you for coming to talk to us again on Bloomberg. He's co-founder of the Lobo Institute, and he knows what he's talking about, having served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for the Middle East. Great insights today as well from Billy House. The bills are moving on Capitol Hill, and it sounds like things might be calming down, at least for a moment, in Israel and in Iran as they try to map out their next moves. We have much more ahead on Balance of Power. Stay with us on Bloomberg.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
First, the G7 condemned the unprecedented Iranian attack on Israel. Unprecedented in scope and scale. Scope because it was a direct attack on Israel from Iran. Scale because it involved more than 300 munitions, including ballistic missiles. We're committed to Israel's security. We're also committed to de-escalating, to trying to bring this tension to a close.
That was Secretary of State Antony Blinken speaking at the G7 alongside many other U.S. allied countries, including some from Europe. And so we want to get more perspective now from the European Commission. Valdis Dombrovskis is joining us now here in our Washington, D.C. studio on Bloomberg Television and Radio. He is the European Commission Executive Vice President for an Economy That Works for People. Sir, thank you so much for being here with us today. If we could first begin, given the developments overnight in the Middle East, knowing that you primarily look at the economy, how concerned are you about possible escalation from here and the impact that that could have on energy prices, which we know has been highly problematic for the European economy in years past?
First of all, we see that the world economy is proving to be resilient despite a difficult situation and different geopolitical tensions and conflicts we are currently experiencing. And also the impact on energy prices so far has been quite limited. Obviously, we need to monitor closely all of those developments, but the assessment is that the risks to the economic outlook are now broadly balanced.
You've been in Washington here meeting with lawmakers about the big story that we've been talking about here for months, Mr. Executive Vice President. And just today we saw an important procedural vote pass for funding for Ukraine, Israel, and the Indo-Pac region. You're obviously very concerned about funding for Ukraine. What did you tell lawmakers when you met with them?
Indeed, that was my main message in the meetings on the Hill. And basically, I was emphasizing that from the EU side, mm-hmm. we are doing a lot to provide financial, but also military and other kind of support to Ukraine. So far, we have provided support of around 100 billion euros. We now have 50 billion euros Ukraine facility for the 4 years, 2024-2027. We are already disbursing from this facility. So it's important that also other international donors and first and foremost U.S. come also with their contribution. And therefore, I'm very much look forward for tomorrow's votes. Mm-hmm. And hopefully this Ukraine support is being approved, because what we see is that in the last months, actually, the situation in Ukraine is deteriorating for the lack, especially of military support. We see it both at the front line, and we see it with daily shellings of Ukrainian cities, residential areas, critical infrastructure. So this support is very much needed. I would say the collective West has all the necessary resources to stop Russia, not to allow this shelling to take place. Mm-hmm. So hopefully this period of undecision and dithering is coming to the end, mm-hmm. and we will be able to come with a strong and firm response to Russia, and also to other autocrats around the world, because it's also not only about Ukraine, it's about our collective security.
Mm-hmm. Well, sir, as you outlined there, the amount that Europe already has contributed to the Ukrainian cause, it's worth pointing out that there is at least a faction of thought here in the United States that thinks Europe is not carrying as much weight as it should be. One of them is the presumptive Republican nominee, former President Donald Trump, posted on social media yesterday, effectively, to summarize his words, saying that Ukrainian survival is more important to Europe than it is to the U.S. So why is Europe not giving more money to help Ukraine? Why can't it equalize or match the money? This is a quote put in by the United States of America. Is there more that Europe could be doing, sir? I wonder what your response would be. to Donald Trump?
First of all, facts has never been the strong side of Donald Trump, and it's also, unfortunately, this time the case. So that's why I'm emphasizing so much the financial aid EU has already provided, which is 100 billion euros in all kind of support. The Ukraine facility, which is already in place of 50 billion euros. So the fact is that EU is the largest donor to Ukraine, and we are willing to continue this way because, after all, indeed, it's a war on Ukrainian, on European continent. But, of course, it also requires solidarity from the broader democratic world, and with EU and US being strategic allies, US support is not only financially very important, but also as a signal of West being united against this Russian aggression.
Mm-hmm. Of course, Donald Trump's view reflects the view of some Republican members in the House who are voting against this package. I wonder, when you met with lawmakers this week, what was your reception? Did you hear pushback? Did you hear criticism? Or were you well-received with the lawmakers you met with?
I would say views were definitely varying on this topic, but my point was really to make the case why it's important not only for Ukraine but for entire global security architecture, mm-hmm. because what we are seeing is that also other autocrats are seeing if the West is not even able to contain Russia, that they're also having ideas, and the recent Iran attack against Israel is just another manifestation of this. Mm-hmm. So from that point of view, it's important to stay firm and determined. Another one, to make this point on the EU's contribution so far, to really show that EU is doing a lot. The EU is actually doing more than the United States. We're happy to continue to do so, but everyone has to contribute.
Yeah.
Well, of course, sir, your conversations here in Washington have not just been limited to lawmakers. You are also here while the IMF World Bank meetings are underway. And I wonder, from an economic lens, what you are hearing in the messaging and what message you are providing about the state of the European economy right now, knowing that for now policy is still tight and there's questions around when it will ease and where the economy will be depending on when that easing actually happens. How are you thinking about the outlook for Europe? As the IMF essentially said, there could be a soft landing, but there are risks here.
Indeed, as I was saying before, actually, the global economy is proving resilient to both current geopolitical tensions and also to the process of disinflation through which we now have to go through. So the expectations for a global growth is of 3.2% of both this year and next. That's the IMF's World Economic Outlook. As regards the EU, we are expecting 0.9% growth this year, 1.7% growth next year. It's somewhat subdued growth right now, one could say, but at the same time, despite a war on the European continent, despite the need to tame high inflation, different disruptions we are facing, EU's economy is nevertheless growing.
I want to ask you about another foreign policy matter that you've been concerned with, and that's China supplying components to Russia and potentially evading sanctions. There's an economic element to this. There's obviously a geopolitical element to it. How big of a problem is this becoming?
That's certainly a cause of concern, and there are two elements. One is circumvention of sanctions, but also another is, in a sense, backfilling mm-hmm. of the sanctions, and we are engaged with China on both of those elements. So, in a sense, what we are doing, we have what we call a high-priority battlefield items list, meaning items which we are finding in Ukrainian battlefields, in Russian military equipment.
Yeah.
We are tracing the origin of this different kind of components.
Is this lethal weaponry?
Yes, it's Russian military weaponry which is being found on Ukrainian battlefields. And because it's not only about weapons deliveries, there's also many dual-use components, if we talk about semiconductors, all kind of other components. So we're tracing it back where it actually origins, because we must face there's also still quite a few of those components of Western origin which are reaching Russia. So we also need to work with our own companies, both in the EU and US, making sure that they are not engaged in those sanctions circumvention. And in the EU, we also have a possibility actually to go after the companies which are knowingly engaging in these kind of activities. We are putting also requirements on no resell to Russia on exports of dual use items. Mm-hmm. We are actually coordinating this work quite a lot with US. We recently also put certain measures against Chinese and Hong Kong companies which are involved in sanctions circumvention by prohibiting EU companies to do any business with them. Mm-hmm. So there are things which we can do, and it's clear as we are now putting strict sanctions against Russia, EU, US, other players. Russia is looking at the ways to circumvent them, so we need to stay alert, follow the patterns, and to the extent possible, close the circumvention mm-hmm. and possible loopholes.
Valdis Dombrovskis with a view from the European Commission. We appreciate your making us part of your week here in Washington, and I hope the spring meetings of the IMF continue well for you. Thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you.
On Bloomberg. Thank you. Kaylee, a lot to cover there as we consider a vote on the Repo Act tomorrow that plays into this Ukraine story in a big way.
Yeah, the so-called sidecar fourth piece of legislation that has not just repo, but also that TikTok divestiture bill, all of that mm-hmm. going to be bundled together and sent to the Senate. Chuck Schumer says it could be a working weekend for senators too, not just the House. And we'll have more on that with our political panel next on Bloomberg.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
I am Kaylee Lyons alongside Joe Matthew in Washington, where it's also busy here. The House has passed one rule for four different measures that they will vote on Saturday. We know, Joe, that this rule mm-hmm. had bipartisan support, helping to move forward this $95 billion foreign aid package. I wonder, though, when it becomes a chance to vote for each of these packages individually, Ukraine, Israel, Indo-Pacific, the sidecar with everything else in it, what the vote breakdown is going to look like, and if as many Democrats will show up for the Israel funding.
That's a question.
As for others, mm-hmm. and perhaps maybe they're more likely to after what we saw overnight with potential further escalation, though not as escalatory as it could have been as Israel strikes Iran.
Well, and I guess that was the plan here from Mike Johnson, right? He knew mm-hmm. that Dems might have a problem with Israel. He certainly knew that his Republican conference had a problem with Ukraine. I don't know what everyone thinks about TikTok at this point. Of course, the House already moved a TikTok divest or ban bill. And so, yeah, the margins might look a little different for each of these. Either way, the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, is pretty happy with what he sees here in a rule that passed. It took more Democrats than Republicans to do it. And he talked to reporters earlier today. Here's the speaker.
It's not the legislation that we would write if Republicans were in charge of both the House, the Senate, and the White House. This is the best possible product that we can get under these circumstances to take care of these really important obligations. And
we did the best we could, the message from the speaker as we assembled our panel. Rick Davis and Jeannie Shanzano, Bloomberg Politics contributors. Great to have you both with us here as we actually prepare for voting. Jeannie, let's get to what Kaylee was talking about here. Are we going to see a sizable number of Democrats vote no on funding for Israel this day after the retaliation against Iran?
Yeah, I think that's going to be one of the curious things to watch. You all were talking about the attack last night. In New York here, a lot of local attention on the protests at Columbia University, where students are asking the university to divest from their investments in Israel. So this is a lot of tension on the ground. We saw San Francisco not that many days ago. So I do think there's a possibility we do see at least a call to place more conditions on that aid. But I think all in all, in the end, this is going to pass. But with all of these sort of four buckets, if you will, in this larger mm-hmm. bill, I think we're going to see some strange bedfellows. And that's going to be one of the dramatic things tomorrow is how much do these bills or the separate bills pass, assuming all four or at least three of the four seem on their way to passage.
Well, Rick, we know what a lot of the progressive Democrats who take issue with Israel's policy in Gaza have been pushing for is Israel to have more constraint, or restraint rather, in the consideration of the civilian death toll here. They would like them to be more restrained in their operations, focusing more on humanitarian aid. But there also has been a lot of push for Israeli restraint in response to what we saw Iran do last weekend. Has Israel actually heeded that message? Is that what we learned overnight? That, okay, when the U.S. and allies do call for restraint in what could have potentially been a very escalatory incident, Israel seems largely to have done that.
Yeah, I think that would be our guess. The fact that Secretary Blinken did not criticize Israel today for any of their actions and actually was pretty quiet about the entire incursion. I mean, like, Israel launches a drone strike in Iran. Any other day, that would be above the fold headline, creating a global crisis. Now it almost seems like, oh, thank God they did that. And I would say the only criticism that I've seen of any real value is within Netanyahu's own war cabinet, and you know, he had some of his top allies in his coalition say this was a weak attempt at a response, and so, you know, he was balancing the conservatives in his coalition with the needs of his people and the global attitude toward a broader conflict, and you know, my guess is they probably figured this one out. I mean, the question now is this the end of this sort of messaging phase where, you know, Iran sends a message to Israel, Israel sends a message to Iran? I mean, these aren't really calculated as diminishing capacity on either front. It is really to send messages. And so are we done with the messaging phase, and can we move on now to a more constructive dialogue around the humanitarian crisis and what's going on in Gaza? And there's a big chunk of change in this supplemental package to address some of those humanitarian needs, almost $10 billion. And so this could actually be an incredibly good weekend for the president, because he can look at this and say, I got the supplemental that I basically wanted, and I have a calmer Middle East to where we can actually step off and start finding solutions to the death toll in Gaza. And, you know, that's a— if he can get that done, that's a pretty good week of work.
Fair enough, Jeannie. I wonder your point or your view on Rick's point. Officials were clear here in the U.S. last night that they did get a heads up by Israel, but they wanted to make the point that the U.S. did not green light the response. Does that make a difference to progressives who are already angry at Joe Biden about Israel?
You know, I'm not sure it's going to make that much of a difference politically. I think Israel showed an awful lot of restraint, as Rick was just talking about, in the aftermath, as well as did the administration. I think all sides, or most sides, are hoping that this is the end of it, that Iran doesn't decide to retaliate and the de-escalation was achieved. But I will tell you, some of the reporting we're hearing is the kind of thing that makes people on the left concerned and feel that there is doublespeak, as some people call it, coming out of the administration. And this is the reporting just now that the Biden administration is considering sending tanks, mortars, vehicles to Israel. This is the kind of thing where people on the left say they don't really care what the, you know, sort of muted response was to last night. The fact that their government is still supplying and the civilian situation and the number of casualties and the humanitarian crisis continues is what is the source of a lot of this frustration and angst. And so, you know, that's where I think the political end of this is going to show up. And I think Joe Biden, as usual, is having to walk a really tough, tightrope on this. We heard Blinken supporting Israel and our closest allies and condemning Iran's attack last weekend. But of course, that has done little to assuage the critics on the left. So it's a very tough moment for the administration on all of this.
Yeah, of course, because you're not just an incumbent president and administration, but also trying to actively campaign for president and want to get reelected in November, which just makes this all the more complicated. And of course, the man Biden is running against, the presumptive Republican nominee, Rick, is spending his time not so much maybe focused on geopolitics, although certainly he has been weighing in on Truth Social, but spending a lot of time, including today, at a courtroom in New York. We do now have the jury seated, 12 jurors have been selected, one alternate. We're looking for five more, but it does seem like the jury selection process could wrap up in the not so distant future. And we could potentially be getting into opening statements next week. Rick, how consequential is it going to be when voters start to hear details about an alleged affair between Donald Trump and a porn star and everything that has happened in the aftermath?
Yeah, I think there's been so much written and talked about that Donald Trump has taken advantage of these court cases and that he's raised money off of them and he's turned them into political events. I think he starts to feel the pain when all the details start coming out about, you know, his illicit relationships, you know, with not just the porn star, but also a Playboy model. You know, he's got his own people who are going to testify. Hope Hicks likely will be on the stand. Michael Cohen, who's gotten a lot of press about this. This is going to be horrible. I mean, like, there's no campaign manager on the face of the earth that's going to look at next week and say, oh, this will be great for us. I think we can really win a lot of votes this way. It'll be damage control. And we see them trying to do that by putting people like President Duda in meetings with the president to try and change the topic. But there's only so much you can do while you've got a court case going on all day.
David Pecker is another name as we hear about this operation. The I forget the name of the thing, Kaylee. What do they call the hide and seek, whatever it is that they had going there to basically snuff out stories that were detrimental to Donald Trump by buying off some individuals here? Catch and kill, Elizabeth, thank you for helping me out. That testimony could resonate more than some of the others, Jeannie. How will it play?
Oh, you know, I think I agree with Rick on this. I think it's going to be very tough. You know, I was just talking to a group of young people not that long ago who don't watch all that closely, and they just scratched their head at the idea that he is in the first of four criminal trials. Even those who support him and say, how can this person run for office and potentially be the next president? So I think next week is critical because all of this we've been talking about these trials comes home to roost and people actually see the reality, which is that person so close to the White House may indeed be found guilty of 34 counts in a criminal trial.
All right, Jeannie Shanzano and Rick Davis, our Bloomberg Politics contributors, thank you both so much. And just to bring you the latest on Trump's hush money trial up in New York, all six alternates have now been selected.
Wow.
So we have a full panel of alternates and jurors for this case, Joe.
Opening statements on Monday. Isn't that what that means?
Potentially. They do have a half day Monday and Tuesday for Passover, but next week it looks like it could happen.
Remarkable.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
With actual news on Capitol Hill, they passed a rule that should not be news. But after rules failed seven times already for this speaker, it was a big deal to see Democrats line up behind him, a few more than Republicans today, to pass the rule that will allow all these separate funding bills to be stitched together into a single body and sent to the Senate. The line from Thomas Massey, one of the Republicans, now two who have joined Marjorie Taylor Greene with her motion to vacate, says it all. He takes to Twitter. The U.S. House is now officially in an alternate universe where the speaker shares procedural power with Democrats. Kaylee Lyons, is that not true at this point of the game?
Well, I guess effectively, if you need Democrats to get everything over the finish line because you can't get enough Republican votes.
Yeah.
And you might need Democrats to save your gavel if this motion to vacate actually is acted upon by Marjorie Taylor Greene and her two buddies in this effort. Then, yeah, you rely on Democrats at the very least. Do we go all the way and say this is a coalition government?
Yeah, but it's maybe not a formal power sharing agreement.
Right. But maybe that's one step too far, but maybe we're not far from it.
Mick's going to pull us in from the ledge on this.
Is he? Mick Mulvaney, the former Republican congressman from South Carolina, of course, former acting chief of staff under the Trump administration. He has a litany of other titles as well. Mick, always great to have you here on Balance of Power. What's your take on what's happening in the House and the extent to which Mike Johnson is not relying on his own party, but the other to get his job done?
Hey, Kaylee, Joe, it's good to see you guys. As I actually sit here just jotting down some notes as you were doing your little intro, and the word I wrote about three times was exactly what Kaylee just said. This is a coalition government. That's exactly what this is right now. And let's geek out a little bit, shall we, on house procedure, if that's okay.
Yes.
This is kind of yes. Geek,
right. rules are supposed to pass on party lines. And when the speaker's committee, and the rules committee is the speaker's committee, the speaker puts all the Republicans on that particular committee. When that committee cannot pass a rule out, and you have to rely on the Democrats, then you are now in a coalition government. You're now passing stuff that is acceptable to a majority of both Republicans and Democrats, a coalition style government. Keep in mind what a rule is. Because of the arcane way that the House of Representatives works, there aren't really any rules until you set a rule for every single piece of legislation. That rule includes when it will be debated, how long it will be debated, who gets to speak and for how long, which amendments will be in order or allowed to be debated and voted on, et cetera. Without that, you have to do what you guys mentioned in the intro, which is do a suspension of the rules, which is essentially just bring something down and see if 2/3 of the people support it. If so, it passes. This is, again, a bizarre way to do business, but it's the way the House has worked for generations. When the Republicans need the Democrats or vice versa to pass a rule, which is what you have to bring a bill to the floor where it can pass with a simple majority, you have a coalition government. And that's what's functioning right now in the House.
Well, that's remarkable. I thought you were going to say, come on, guys, give them a break. This isn't a formal power sharing agreement. But we read you, Mick, and I guess I'm just wondering what happens next then. If this is, in fact, a coalition-style government, whatever we're going to call it, that would also protect him from being fired, right?
Well, that's the test, right? I mean, I know if you all saw what Kevin McCarthy said. I can't remember what the outlet was last week. He said he thought that he had an understanding from the Democrats that they would come to his aid,
right.
Which is why he said reach out, because he didn't want to spoil his relationship with his own party. And it might be that Mike has something formal, something informal. It might be Mike thinks they're coming to his aid, but we won't really know until the vote happens. And that's why, let's get to the interesting stuff, right? The vote to vacate the chair is a privileged motion. So anybody, now that it's been filed and it's ripened, it's sat in the hopper for X number of days, it can be brought up at any time by anyone. And once it is, it stops all other activity. So if Marjorie Taylor Greene and Thomas Massie are sincere about trying to stop what's happening on the floor, they could, in theory, not in theory, they could actually bring the motion now and bring the House to a halt, at least temporarily while they vote, or semi-permanently if it passes until they reach until they hire a new speaker.
Well, Mick, I think it's interesting that some of those who cast a vote to oust Kevin McCarthy last fall are suggesting that they would not do so again this time because they have serious concerns. Either it's going to hurt the Republicans electorally come November, or because there's a real chance that Hakeem Jeffries could end up the House Speaker. What's different now that wasn't true when we were dealing with Kevin McCarthy inside the Republican Party, including the House Freedom Caucus? Bob Good does not seem to want to go along with us. Can you just try to take us inside that room and work through what you think they might be thinking?
Yeah, I think some of the folks are starting to realize what poor decision making they may have made when they removed Kevin McCarthy. They sort of brought this stain on the reputation of the Republican Party and didn't get better policies out of it anyway. So I think they're scratching their heads going, maybe all those people like Mulvaney who are saying this is a stupid move might have been right. By the way, one of my favorite sayings is that the biggest lie in Washington, D.C. is, I hate to say I told you so. Everybody loves saying I told you so in Washington, D.C. But I think a lot of folks are starting to realize that. I wouldn't diminish the role of Donald Trump here. I don't think Donald Trump, and that's the reason you saw him with Mike Johnson this week, was because he doesn't want this distraction. Okay, he wants the negative focus that's on Biden now about the economy and Biden's inability to navigate what's happening in the Middle East. And he wants the attention on his trials, which he is using now to his political gain. If the Republicans replace a speaker or move to replace a speaker, that goes to the top of the media list and it kicks him down one, maybe two notches, and he doesn't like that. So I think it's a combination of things, but keep in mind, and we had this conversation, Kaylee, with John Boehner the day before he retired. He called a bunch of us into a room and said, or I think it was six or eight of us, and said, are y'all going to bring the motion to vacate? And because it had been sitting there sort of like it is now for Mike Johnson. And we said, you know, Mr. Speaker, no, we won't. We'll give you our word on that. But if anybody else does, we are going to vote to vacate the chair. And that's the question right now is, are those folks out there who are saying, you know, I don't want to change a speaker. Let's not change a speaker. Now it's bad for the party, et cetera. If the vote actually comes down, will they vote to keep Mike Johnson in there or will they vote to vote him out?
Well, it's really something. As your former House Freedom Caucus weighs in on this, to Kaylee's point, they met last evening and decided that this motion to vacate was a bad idea. Mick, is it about the devil you know? The Freedom Caucus doesn't want a Steve Scalise or a Tom Emmer to replace Mike Johnson, or, God forbid, in their view, a Hakeem Jeffries, right?
I don't think the Hakeem Jeffries is a possibility is for real, but there might be a compromised person. But I think the bottom line is that I think they've now realized that the things they didn't like about what was happening under Kevin McCarthy's speakership was not because of Kevin McCarthy. It was because they have a 3 or 4 or 5 vote margin, period. That's it. And replacing Mike Johnson with any other Republican is not going to change any outcomes at this point. Nobody who they can imagine in their wildest dreams. Keep in mind, Mike Johnson was praised by the right wing when he took over as Speaker. He was their win. I remember the right wing groups claiming that this is what it was all about. It was worth it to get rid of McCarthy because look at the great conservative and things are going to be different now. And yay team, and we were right. And now they're sort of looking their hands over and go, maybe it wasn't a personality driven thing or an individual driven thing. Maybe it was systemic. And I think that's correct. This is what you get when your majority is only 4 or 5 people. And I think now some of them are starting to realize that.
Mick Mulvaney, great to see you, Mick. Thanks for coming back to talk to us. We'd love to connect next week once this is all done. Co-founder of the House Freedom Caucus, of course, a former congressman and former acting chief of staff in the Trump administration. Thanks for listening to the Balance of Power podcast. Make sure to subscribe if you haven't already at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find us live every weekday from Washington, D.C. at noontime Eastern at Bloomberg.com.